Welcome back to the Country House Podcast. Today's subject of discussion is one that I am going to find, I know, and in preparing for it, have found it to be quite fascinating, which is all about follies. And, you know, there's so much nuance and things we could talk about with this that I'm sure it will take a number of episodes in the future. But for now, we're just going to have an overview of follies, and starting off with heading straight to Connor. Talking about the origin of follies, where did they start? And, you know, this is in itself an interesting discussion that would probably take hours, because we look at European depictions of the Tower of Babel going all the way back there, and how it's a high tower that was interestingly ambiguous in its purpose, but yet there's so much meaning to it. And so, you know, arguably you could go all the way back to that, depending on how philosophical you want to be, but how about that, Connor?
Well, a folly in the sense that we would think of on a country estate really stems from the 18th century. Of course, there were follies or buildings that would fall under that category before that, but we'll mostly focus on the 18th century onwards, because it was from the 17th century paintings by artists such as Claude Lorrain that you had the classical landscape, this ideal setting, a romantic setting of temples, ruins in a pasture, and trees and distant waters and mountains. And these landscape paintings played a pivotal role in influencing the creation of such landscapes in reality. And so on a country estate, it was the creation of this Arcadian ideal. And most follies will have been built as eye catchers, the landscape. So they will be either in relation to the approach to the house, perhaps, or within the house, it might align with the central door or one of the side windows, that when you're in the center of the drawing room, in the distance, you have a perfect alignment with the folly. It's an eye catcher. But in what we, I suppose, we're focusing on is the follies that serve no purpose beyond to look decorative, to be beautiful objects in the landscape. And this countryside ideal, it influenced, of course, the English landscape painter Constable, who said of Claude Lorrain that he was the finest landscape painter in the world. But thinking of the early 18th century and the country estate, it was the classical temple that, in many cases, it was circular. So you had columns laid in a circle with a dome on top, and it might be placed, as I was saying, in relation to the house, an eye catcher in the landscape. Now, it did provide a purpose in the sense of shelter. It was a reason to walk in that direction. You might invite a guest to walk to the folly, and in that way that you have a conversation, you stop at the folly, you go back to the house, whatever it may be. But later in the 18th century, as a reaction to these perfect classical temples, there was a move towards the rustic and more romantic, and as seen as more in touch with nature, as opposed to the perfectly refined temple. And the rustic was the hermit's house, the hermitage. I'm thinking of Tollymoor in County Down, where on the, I think it's 1770s, James Hamilton, in remembrance of a deceased friend, built a rustic temple. And these look as though, they're meant to look as though they are primitive. They are prehistoric, perhaps, the ancient owners of this land. And in some cases, to appear as though they were not built by man at all. I'm thinking of Ballyfin Estate, the rustic temple. It has stone monolithic columns in front. And when we say rustic, we're thinking stonework, creating a wall, but it's not dressed or finished in the way that you'd expect of a stonemason, a craftsman. So it has that primitive sense of stones being found in a field and assembled to create this object. And that then continued. So you had started off in the early 18th century with the polished, perfect temple. That then transitioned into the rustic and the natural. And then beyond that, you got a mix of the two. So you would have the maybe the late Georgian period, you would find handsome temples, but they would have rustic elements to them. So it was a combination of the two. And in Downton Abbey, which we touched on in our previous or two episodes ago, the temple and the placement is a feature used by the film director. So its alignment with the house is perfect. It's a theatrical setting. And so even today, when they're making a film on the site, on the estate, the positioning of the temple as it was imagined is being used by those making this production. And the temple that's just adjacent to the house, I think it's the closest. It's a pediment supported by, I believe, five or six Corinthian columns. And it's adjacent to the house, parallel to one of the side elevations. And it serves no purpose other than something to look at that is beautiful. And beauty is its purpose. And to a modern listener in the 20th century, we talk of beauty being in the eye of the beholder. But of course, that is very much a modern way of looking at it. That if you asked a Georgian architect what he thought of this structure, he would say beauty is objective, that there is subjectivity in taste and what flavor, what style. Of course, you might go Gothic, you might go classical and so on. But there is a right way and a wrong way of doing a temple. And a trained eye, in fact, a trained eye can achieve it, but an untrained eye, every single person has this eye within them. They can see a temple that's out of proportion in the landscape and say, there's something wrong. I can't put my finger on it, but something's not right. And these temples are, I suppose, just sentinels in the landscape that represent good standards of architecture. They are to be measured by architectural students in order to learn the classical tradition. So very important objects in the landscape.
That's really helpful, Connor. I think you've touched on another subject that I would love to do an episode on, which is objective beauty in a subjective world. I gave a lecture at a university in Texas last year on the philosophy of beauty in the built environment. And I talked a lot about that, you know, talking about how even the sort of most formidable brutalists acknowledge that the Sistine Chapel or St. Paul's Cathedral are beautiful buildings, yet their buildings are clearly subjectively beautiful because predominantly people dislike brutalism, and it's quite a small subset of society that like it. So I think that it would be great to do some episodes, certainly on the philosophy of beauty in the built environment and what is object and what is subjective beauty when it comes to country house building. But talking of follies, it's really helpful, I guess, to think about what makes folly and where it gets its name from. So the name itself, folly, obviously implies that it's not got a purpose. I think the Oxford English Dictionary defines folly as a popular name for any costly structure considered to have shown folly in the builder or the patron. So even though follies are some of the most beautiful things in our landscapes, they were often seen or are seen as not having a point to them, except, as you mentioned, to look beautiful. Of course, we know that not to be true. Some follies were used as summer houses, just beautiful summer houses. Some are now converted, and we can talk about this later, into holiday nets. But what sets follies apart from other garden ornaments is that they are buildings, or at least parts of buildings. Some of them are shams. Some of them are literally just facades. So you think about sham castles in the grounds of some country houses, which is literally just the facade of a ancient castle that's made to give the owner of the estate a sort of the appearance of having been there for much longer than they are. Because, of course, we've talked in the past about how estates develop organically over time and houses were knocked down and reconstructed. And the idea of sham castles in the grounds of country houses was partly to make people think that the family maybe had been there for much longer. If it was a Gothic or Norman castle ruin, it might make people think they'd been there since the Norman Conquest, when perhaps they hadn't been. So there's lots of different purposes to follies. But one of the key things is they are buildings or parts of buildings as opposed to statues or sculptures. they're also purpose built. So they're not, they're made to look beautiful and have, you know, sometimes trivial, sometimes more serious purposes, but they're not necessarily, they don't necessarily have a purpose. Some of them, like a sham castle, for example, might simply be for appearance as an eye catcher. So there's often an element of fakery in their construction. This is the ruins that you see as follies. And supposedly they were commissioned for pleasure, but many follies were commissioned for more than pleasure. So I'm thinking back particularly to the Irish follies during the Great Famine in Ireland. Many follies were commissioned to provide employment for peasants and artisans. So say you already had a house, but you wanted to provide employment for people who, farmers, for example, or peasants who were hungry or starving. It gave them employment. And this was seen in England as well. So I'm thinking, for example, it's not a folly, so to speak, but the Baring family commissioned a carriage drive around along a clifftop in South Devon on their estate. I think I've talked before about the Baring family's estate down there with the bull and the bear gate piers that reminded people who entered of the fact that the Baring family made their money as bankers in the bull and bear markets. But Lord Ashburton, who was sort of head of the Baring family, he commissioned a carriage drive around the cliff tops around his estate. And then during particularly troubled times when people were struggling, he employed people to widen the carriage drive. And that's an example of benevolent landowners trying to give employment to people by creating pleasurable things for themselves. And I think follies are a good example of that. You know, follies don't often have often didn't have a specific purpose. It might have simply been a summer house or a banqueting house, somewhere to throw parties or somewhere to have tea or somewhere to have a shoot lunch. It might simply be a facade that has no purpose at all except to look beautiful. But there are so many great follies, and I think it'll be helpful to talk about some follies specifically. Ben, have you got a particularly favourite folly?
Well, yes, actually. And it's interesting, we've been talking about purpose and intention, which I think, again, we could go on for hours about. You know, we know of many follies that are used as bathhouses or grottos, homes of collections of shells and fossils. Many are used to commemorate battles, for example, or the sham ruins fascinate me. You know, there's one, I don't know if you've been to Painshill Park in Surrey, but they have this white Gothic abbey screen wall that it fascinates me, those. But particularly the discussion of beauty as a purpose in itself, and also the follies that were designed in protest or with a specific rather than a look in mind, a specific virtue in mind to convey to a walker. And so I would share one of my favorites, which is in France, and it's called the Temple to Philosophy. And it was built in the mid-18th century. But it's sort of a half-finished Greek temple, classical Greek temple. But it was left purposefully unfinished because the architect wanted to symbolize an endless quest for knowledge. So you have this half-structured, rustic Greek temple. And that's always fascinated me as a representation of that kind of folly where, you know, we look and we think, especially in those times where perhaps there was a greater class divide, it may have looked upon as building something like that to be a transgression or something to cause offense. But then we look back on it now as sort of an immediate historical event where the owner and creator is designing symbolism and creating architecture for the sole purpose of beauty or symbolism, which the Temple to Philosophy has always fascinated me as a structure.
Conor, have you got a particularly favourite folly? Perhaps the casino at Marino in Ireland. You could talk to us about that. It might not be your favourite, but it's an extraordinary folly.
That really is beautiful.
The casino at Marino is amazing. Sir William Chambers. In fact, I measured that on work experience years ago during uni. And it's a magnificent structure. The estate, the country house that it was built for, is long gone. The estate has broken up entirely, but this folly. I suppose it's not really a folly, though, in the sense that it does have rooms and a kitchen, and it has a use beyond looking beautiful. But thinking of a beautiful folly, and where would you see such structures, and what comes close to these Claude Lorraine paintings? I'm thinking of it's his landscape with shepherds, I think, from the 1640s. If you visit Stourhead, you will see perhaps the finest English landscape ever made. And this was the vision of the Hoare family who built Stourhead. This is like stepping into a painting. The trees, the lake, the bridge, the undulating landscape, it's all in harmony and it fits so comfortably together. And the placement of the follies, the temples, are in such a way that as the viewer moves through the landscape, they get glimpses of, from different angles, of different follies, different temples. And as you move slowly through it, you're moving through a theatrical setting. So think of before the age of cinema, you know, it's real life entertainment. But back to why perhaps, why were these built? We must also understand that as we look at these today, we have different way of thinking on certain on things and approaches than we would have 200 years ago. People did not travel as much then. So creating as beautiful as possible, making your estate as beautiful as possible, this is the place you're going to spend a lot of time, as opposed to jetting off to go skiing or whatever it might be. And of course, there was the Grand Tour, which young gentlemen would have went to Rome for a year, and on that brought back, and we've touched on this on other episodes, that Grand Tour was pivotal in bringing the classical world, bringing the beauty of antiquity to Britain. And although that was a tour and that was part of, I suppose, growing up and sort of becoming a cultured gentleman, it wasn't something like nowadays where people are jetting off on holidays. So the creating a beautiful, the classical Arcadian landscape, the idyll, was certainly, I would imagine, a key motivation. But Stourhead, in particular, just to Jeff's question of a beautiful temple, there is the Temple of Apollo. And this was designed by Henry Flitcroft, who I believe was also responsible, if I could be mistaken, with Wentworth Woodhouse. But this folly is directly inspired by a ruin at Baalbek. And to visit that site today, it's a very dangerous part of the world in Baalbek. But this temple's influenced by that, and it has a sort of Baroque appearance. It has a constantly changing, a semicircular changing entablature. It's a circular temple with a domed roof. And I would recommend any of our listeners to visit Stourhead to really appreciate an English landscape garden and follies at their best, completely designed for that landscape.
Many of our listeners will probably recognize the Temple of Apollo from the 2005 version of Pride and Prejudice. There are many scenes in there. It is really stunning. Jeff, how about you? Any favorites from you?
That's right. I mean, Stourhead is probably, like Connor said, the most Arcadian landscape in Britain. And it's not just the Temple of Apollo. I mean, there's that incredible view that's famous of the view from the banks of the lake across the Palladian Bridge to the Pantheon, because they have they have their own version of the Pantheon as another folly on the lake in Stourhead. I mean, the only landscape I can think of that rivals Stourhead, both from its Arcadian beauty and also its follies, is Stowe House in Buckinghamshire, which I've posted about recently on the Country House podcast Instagram page. But it has so many different follies, and I think that's the important thing, is also recognizing whilst Stourhead perhaps focuses on classical follies, Stowe, the Dukes of Buckingham and Chandos, went slightly wild with their with the different periods of follies. So they have Gothic follies, they have Egyptian pyramids, they have Roman temples, they have all sorts of different periods. And it's interesting, you know, not just at Stowe, but at other country houses. There are often you find, I'm thinking of, for example, actually, to be honest with you, so many country houses have Chinese garden. I think of Cowden Japanese Garden in Scotland, which is the only Japanese garden in Scotland. And it was the Japanese garden for a now long lost country house or castle. But the garden still belongs to the family, the Stewart family. And Sarah Stewart, who's an old friend of mine, showed me around Cowden Japanese Garden, which they've restored. And it's amazing because the whole garden is a folly, because it's there simply to be enjoyed. There's oriental bridges, there are grottos and stepping stones and little temples and all sorts, all in the Japanese style. So if you think of country houses with Chinese or Japanese gardens, those are, the whole garden often is a folly, not just the ornaments that within it. But it's important to think about how follies evolved. So yes, the Grand Tour brought the classical follies to England, so Roman temples, Greek temples that symbolize the classical virtues. But similarly, over the course of the 18th century, you saw Oriental temples, you saw Egyptian pyramids, medieval castles or abbeys, sometimes Turkish tents like at Painshill Park, all representing different eras, continents. Sometimes you had ornamental windmills or sort of ancient medieval houses that were built as follies in the grounds of 18th century or 19th century country houses as a means of sort of, again, grounding the family in their history and their land. But for me, my favorite follies are actually ones that are now lived in. So there are two particular follies that I'm slightly obsessed with, and I've talked about these to you both before, I think, or certainly to my friends before, other friends before, but there are two follies that were lived in by well-known interior designers. So I'm thinking of the temple at Stoke-by-Nayland in Suffolk, which I posted about on the Instagram page just a few days ago, which is an exquisite. It was built as sort of a boating house or a summer lodge on this lovely canal on this estate in Suffolk. It was actually later the home of David Hicks, the famous 20th century interior designer, who basically rescued it from ruin and turned it into the most beautiful home. And it's now lived in by the very talented interior designer Vera Grenny, who's done many of our greatest country houses as an interior designer with his English country house style. But yeah, so the temple at Stoke-by-Nayland is a really pretty house with a wonderful outlook and aspect. And again, it's been expanded over time. So it's now got a couple of bedrooms. It's got an amazing sort of piano nobile overlooking this canal. But it's the history for me that it's been lived in by two of the great interior designers of the 20th century who have made it beautiful, and it's been photographed for many magazines. And the other folly I'm thinking of is another one that I posted on the Instagram page recently, which is King Henry's Hunting Lodge near Odiham in Hampshire, which is a really beautiful gabled red brick folly overlooking a lake. And it was for many years the home of Nicky Haslam, the renowned interior designer who's still going strong in his 80s, I believe. And Nicky lived there for many years. It actually belongs to the National Trust, but is leased from the trust. Nicky gave up the lease a few years ago, and it now belongs to another interior designer. But it's a really iconic building. And for me, and the reason why it's so iconic is because before Nicky lived there, it was lived in by John Fowler, who was one of the co-founders of Colfax and Fowler, along with Sybil Colfax. So probably the most famous country house interior design firm, which is Colfax and Fowler. One half of that, John Fowler, lived at King Henry's Hunting Lodge. And it's just a really pretty home now. And that's the thing, you know, a lot of these follies, they're small, but they're so perfect. Often they're stately and miniature. They're sort of a pocket-sized country house. So for people who perhaps don't have the capital but have the appreciation or the aesthetic eye, follies are highly sought after as homes. And actually perhaps the great salvation for follies, because during the period of the destruction of the English country house, when so many houses were being turned down, follies were seen as even more worthless than the houses, because, you know, the houses at least had salvageable materials. Follies were seen as slightly pointless. And the Landmark Trust, which is a charity that rescues essentially historic buildings and turns them into holiday lets, rescued many follies. I'm thinking of banqueting houses and very ornate piggeries, even, you know, a whole mix of follies and all sorts of different purposes originally, but they've all been converted into wonderful holiday lets that can be, for our listeners out there who are interested in staying in a sort of on an estate in a sort of miniature stately home. The Landmark Trust is a great organization to book holiday stays through, because they've rescued and restored these crumbling little follies and made them often into two bed or three bed cottages that are perfect for weekend or week long escapes. I've got lots of favorite follies, but I think for me, those two that I mentioned that have that interior design aspect to them, the Templet Stoke by Nayland and King Henry's Hunting Lodge, are probably my favorite follies.
That's fantastic. I appreciated that you posted King Henry's Hunting Lodge on Instagram today on our page, that we could benefit from that before recording this. That was beautiful. And I forgot to mention also, one of my favorites was Broadway Tower by James Wyatt, obviously the one visited frequently by William Morris. That one's always quite striking to see. But there's also the you have to mention the eccentric ones as well, the ones that really amuse and confuse. There's, in terms of amuse, I love the Dunmore Pineapple up in Scotland. I love that one. That's a great one. People listening should definitely Google that one.
Well, Ben, I've got a little story to tell you about the Dunmore Pineapple. The Dunmore Pineapple is actually a Landmark Trust property, and it can be rented for holidays. It's quite inaccessible. The Dunmore Pineapple, for our listeners, is a folly built into the wall of a walled garden that's no longer gardened. The garden is just laid to turf, but it's essentially it was sort of a garden shed originally, a gardener's cottage, with an enormous stone pineapple on top, which would have told all the other Scots who had never left Scotland how well travelled the builder or the owner, the patron, was. But my little story was, last year I was staying up at Dalmeny near Edinburgh, and I was with a friend, and we decided we'd go and visit the Dunmore Pineapple. This friend is also a country house and architectural enthusiast. And we went in the middle of the night, about 11 o'clock at night last March, to try and get to the Dunmore Pineapple. And we couldn't get up the drive because it was closed. So we parked several fields away, and at 10:30 at night, we marched through the fields in our wellies and got to the pineapple. And of course, there are people staying in the house, because it's a Landmark Trust property and people have rented it for the weekend. And there was Jack and I outside taking lots of photographs surreptitiously with our night camera lenses on, so that we could get some good shots of the pineapple. Mercifully, the people inside didn't catch us, because it would have been a bit embarrassing to have found two people outside. We joked that we were sort of the James Lees Milnes of the present age, because James Lees Milne, who we've talked about before, who was the great saviour for country houses, as the guy who worked for the National Trust persuading families to donate their houses to the Trust. He used to go from country house to country house and folly to folly, trying to persuade the owners to give their properties to the Trust. So we felt like we were sort of channeling James Lees Milne's energy on that very muddy evening, and the car got stuck in the mud, and it was a total drama, but it was really fun.
I'm also thinking of the Sugarloaf and the Jack the Treacle Eater. If you've seen that one always amuses. The story of that is great. It's got a guy on the top who's fabled, I believe, to be a local messenger who used to run to London and back, and he was fueled by treacle, they said. But it's a really interesting looking one. And well, I was going to ask from that, Connor, the why is it important to have these sort of places in the landscape to rest the eye or amuse in the landscape?
Yes, the folly not only is an attractive position in the sense of to view it, but also to view from. So they're usually an advantage position that not only to attract you in the direction and therefore a reason to walk or ride in that direction, but also when you do arrive and you have shelter from the rain, perhaps, you have a vista back towards the house. And thinking of Stowe, we think of country estates today that are open to the public as a 20th century remedy to the rising cost of running an estate when other income avenues dried up, or rather there was the punitive taxation and everything, which we've touched on a previous episode. But Stowe was open to the public in the 18th century, and there were brochures, pamphlets printed displaying which architect designed what and guiding you around the estate. So the Gothic temple, which was designed by James Gibbs, that is, I think it's to the liberties of our ancestors is what it's called. You can rent that as part of the Landmark Trust, and looking out from the temple, descending down the hill, you have this beautiful Palladian bridge, an archway on either side with a crowned by a pediment, and the stretch of the bridge is a series of columns, and it's all stone, beautifully classically created, and it sits so wonderfully in the landscape. Within this temple, looking out, it's as though you're within a painting. And this is back to the Arcadian setting. It was inspired by art, and they've created art in the landscape. And so from each folly in Stowe, you're looking out on another distant folly, which you will then walk to after, perhaps. This is talking about their aesthetic purpose and, you know, the beauty that they have. But a lot of follies are designed to commemorate particular moment in time or a person. So in Castletown, Kildare, Lady Louisa Connolly, she had a circular temple built in the landscape, which you can view from the house. And it was by reusing Tuscan columns that were taken from the house gallery. So reusing stone columns from the house and repurposing them for a folly. And she named this the Siddons Folly, after Sarah Siddons, who was a famous actress of the time, who paid a visit to many of the great houses on a tour of Ireland. But another folly, which there's these follies, the tradition does continue, albeit in a less vigorous way, that Robert Adam, famous English architect, still practicing today, designed the Millennium Pavilion for Lord Sainsbury. And this is continuing the tradition of a circular temple, although the dome on top is supported by very thin metallic rods. And I suppose it's continuing the tradition, but it's as though the dome is levitating. And there have been other new follies since then. But thinking of the rustic folly, which you touched on earlier, there was also the resident hermit. So some of these follies, they were, I suppose, pavilions, the ones that have become houses. They were beyond just looking decorative. So you could perhaps call them pavilion, whatever it may be. But there were hermits. So moving towards the rustic, it was a desire to be closer to nature. And the hermit was seen as a monk-like activity, cut off from society and perhaps more innocent of the turmoils and stresses of modern life as it was seen. And the zenith of this close to nature was the resident hermit, where a man would have been employed essentially to live as a hermit in the hermitage on the estate. And they pay a visit, and part of the deal was essentially he'd live in that way. This was, I suppose, Jeff, would you say this is the zenith of the folly having a sort of active role in the landscape? There's someone employed to live within it, and they are part of the theatre.
I think that is probably, you're right, the zenith of the folly, the nature of follies, you know, as being solely aesthetic and creating an atmosphere for the country house owner. I think I'm conscious of time ticking on. It would be helpful to think about not just those individual follies within the grounds of country houses, but perhaps being the Country House podcast, we can finish with perhaps the biggest folly that England's ever known, which was Beckford's Tower in Wiltshire, Fonthill Abbey, which was a house. It was a country house, a Gothic Revival country house, but it was known as Beckford's Folly because of this extraordinary tower he built on the top. It literally looked like a Gothic Revival abbey, but with, you know, you're thinking sort of incredibly high stained glass entrance hall with the staircase rising from the middle. And this tower that he built on top, I think, was 90 meters high. So just imagine how high that is above the central part of the house. And it was seen as Beckford's Folly because Beckford, William Beckford, who built it and commissioned James Wyatt to build it, he was known as the wealthiest commoner in England because he inherited a fortune but didn't have a title. He wasn't a peer. So he was known as the richest commoner in England. But he built this extraordinary 90-meter high tower above his folly that was his abbey, and the tower actually collapsed several times, including its final collapse in 1825, which damaged the abbey so badly the abbey was eventually abandoned and demolished. So actually that's an example of a whole country house that was one man's whimsical vision of an enormous folly, and we could talk more about Fonthill because it's an extraordinary estate that we should definitely do a whole episode on, because we saw a succession of extraordinary country houses over the centuries, and each generation demolished and rebuilt until you had the destruction of Fonthill Abbey when it collapsed, because the tower was unstable. So that's, again, thinking of folly being sort of whimsical and not of substance. That proved to be the case for Fonthill Abbey because ultimately the tower collapsed.
And being quite unusual in that it's Gothic rather than classical, where, of course, the 18th, 19th century Ruskin, the battle between Gothic and classical architecture, who would come out on top. So having a Gothic folly was quite a
statement.
Was quite a rarity. Yeah, of course, there was Batty Langley and his follies, one at Castletown. There's other Batty Langley, beautiful follies in the Gothic tradition with finials and everything, pointed arches, but mostly classical as opposed to Gothic.
Mm-hmm. Well, something I should add to that is I've never been to visit Beckford Tower, but have wanted to, and it reopens next month to the public.
I'll correct you there, Ben. Beckford Tower is near Bath, and that was also the same family, but Beckford Tower is also a folly, but it's not the same as Beckford's Folly, which was Fonthill Abbey, which is in Wiltshire. So you're absolutely right. Same family, same folly builders.
But right.
Beckford's Folly, which is Fonthill Abbey, is sadly no longer. But Beckford's Tower, which is near Bath, is well worth visiting. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, I've got the wrong one in my mind there then. But anyway, before you mentioned Stowe, Connor, and I should point out, if you're interested in looking at Art of Follies, my former boss and perhaps one of the most impactful people in my whole life, Jonathan Miles Lee, did the map for Stowe, and surrounding the map, he did sketches of all of the different follies in there. It's quite amazing. And in fact, remembering him, you mentioned before, Connor, about the importance of objective beauty, and we'll discuss that later. But I always remember sending Jonathan a picture of a house I was walking by and saying, "Isn't this lovely, Jonathan?" And he would reply, "No, absolutely not. The proportions are all out." It's and that just you reminded me of that earlier on. But anyway, this has been fascinating. I was really looking forward to this episode anyway, but it's been great to discuss follies. And there's so much more to talk about. Now, to finish, there were some books that you wanted to refer to. I've enjoyed Celia Fisher's quite new book, The Story of Follies. I enjoyed that. But there was one you wanted to shout out, Jeff.
Yes, that's right. Thanks, Ben. Yeah, Rory Fraser who's a friend of mine and Connor's, wrote a brilliant book on follies, which he illustrated himself, and it explores many of the finest follies in the British Isles. So well worth looking for Rory Fraser's book, Follies, which was only published a few years ago. And we're hoping to get Rory on another episode to talk more about follies and maybe talk about what it's like drawing or painting these extraordinary buildings, because he's got a great love for them, and he's a very talented writer and an artist.
His book was accompanied by a documentary on the follies, which I imagine you'll be able to find online.
Oh, brilliant. So there's an abundance of resources. And with that, we'll close. Thank you all. And, you know, the greatest way to grow a podcast is by word of mouth. So if you're enjoying these, we thank you for all of the support following on the Instagram. And perhaps tell a friend to listen to the podcast on Spotify or Apple. And yes, it's fantastic to be doing this. Thank you for the support. And goodbye.